Hello! We've got a double treat this week. We're picking up again from where we left off with Alex Greenwich, the MP for Sydney. But first, I'll be talking again with James Valentine on his radio show on ABC 702. We'll be talking about buying off the plan, moving furniture through common property, and car stacking. I'm Jimmy Thompson, and this is the Flat Chat Wrap.
We like to invite Jimmy Thompson from flat-chat.com.au to join us because Jimmy knows everything there is to know about strata. This is every kind of dwelling that comes under the rule of strata. Now, I'm just going to stop here. I'm in Canberra, which means Jimmy's in Sydney and I'm in Canberra. I'm getting a strange kind of delay and slap back now that Jimmy's microphone's open. So whatever that might be, don't know, but I'm just pointing it out for Jen and Matt, because then they can look panicked and worry about it. So hopefully that'll stop. Might be Jimmy's headphones might be too loud, something like that, Jimmy.
Yeah, okay.
could be that. Yeah. Anyway, I might be able to deal with it, but I'm just letting people know. I'm sorry to do that on air, but it was easier, really. Anyway, Jimmy Thompson here. If you live in a townhouse, in a unit, in an apartment, in a flat, anything like that, then that's strata, and it's different to living in a house. So we deal with all the things that have to do with strata. You can call in now. The number is 1-300-222-702. You might have particular problems you want to explore. Could be something to do with neighbours or something to do with the annual general meetings coming up, or there's a garden problem, whatever it might be. Jimmy will be able to help you. Jimmy Thompson, very good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Maybe I'm not in Sydney. Maybe I'm in the next studio and you don't even realise it.
That's true.
That's why you're getting the weird noises.
See, we're in a weird kind of virtual reality now. I don't know where you are.
You have no idea. I could be anywhere.
You know what I know?
What's that?
Wherever you are, you're Jimmy Thompson.
That's true. That is sadly true. That is sadly true. I am the man who apparently knows everything there is to know about living in strata, so that's kind of reassuring.
That's reassuring, and so that's probably best that you're here, because that's what we're going to be talking about. So
excellent.
So call now 1-300-222-702 if you've got a question for Jimmy about your strata arrangement, something that's going on in your block, in your units, then we might be able to help you. But a reasonable amount going on in the news at the moment. Let's start perhaps with the Opal Tower, which put a lot of focus, you know, like suddenly there's a building, brand new building in Sydney with a big crack in it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people that were looking to buy or just had bought sent the fear of God through them, really.
Absolutely. And I think the people terrified are those who are, you know, they've signed up for their off-the-plan contracts and the building hasn't been built yet. And they're sitting thinking, well, what's it going to be like in 6 months or a year when we move into this place? Is it going to start crumbling around our ears? Mm. You know, and then the politicians, as politicians are wont to do, start running around issuing, edicts and new plans about things that they're going to do, especially if they get re-elected. And you look at them and go, these are remarkably similar to what we have at the moment. But
really? So a lot of what they're saying is basically, this is what we do right now.
Kind of. I think what they're saying is they're going to make it like all the professionals, the architects, the engineers, the builders, et cetera, are going to be certified, which I kind of thought they were. And they're all going to have to say, we stand by our work, that we did this job. And I kind of thought they had to do that as well. And they're saying that there's going to be a duty of care. Now, this is a legal nicety because it's kind of like the transference of a duty of care has fallen over in terms of the developer gets the builder to build the building and then the developer sells the apartments to people like us. But if the developer comes out of the equation at some point, the builder did not have a duty of care to the owner, the apartment buyer.
Right.
Now, apparently, they're saying that they're going to fix that. Maybe. That's interesting. But what they're saying is that they'll make it easier for owners to get compensation or whatever, or get defects fixed because of this duty of care thing. But it will still end up with a bunch of owners hiring a lawyer to go and attack the lawyers, much more expensive lawyers hired by the developers.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like it's been a long, slow process to get us to a point where we've gone from where you could reasonably expect that if I've paid for this, it should be okay, and if there's not, the person I bought it from will fix it, through to the current situation where I pay for this, and if there's something wrong with it, it's kind of my problem.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking to someone over Christmas there and saying, look, wouldn't it be great if you move into an apartment, the walls, cracks appear in the walls, and you go down to the developer's office on the Monday morning and hand them the keys and say, mate, this is not what I paid for. Here's your keys
well,
back.
Look, I've been saying that a lot, and I don't get why that doesn't apply. I don't get, even if I was if I was in, say, something like the Opal Tower with that sort of situation where I couldn't just go, I'm sorry, I'm out of here, give me my money back. Well, like, if it was a hatchback, I could do that, couldn't I?
Absolutely. And they would take it off you. They'd say, oh, we've discovered a problem with your hatchback.
Yeah, they'd recall them.
Yeah, they'd say, bring it in, we'll fix it for free. Have a cup of coffee while you're waiting.
So why doesn't that sort of consumer law just apply here?
Because of politicians and developers. I think that's it, basically. Right. Politicians and developers, for since the beginning of time, have been in each other's pockets. And, you know, we try and nudge both parties. Look, that is grossly unfair. There are some politicians who are decent, honourable people, and there are some developers who just want to do a decent job and will probably charge you a bit more, but your building is not going to fall over as soon as you move into it. Mm. So there are good players on both sides. But generally, the culture going back decades has been, oh, give us a bit of leeway here. If you make the rules too tight, then we won't be able to build apartment blocks for you, and you need us to build apartment blocks, or we won't be able to house everyone.
And we've all stood by and allowed this to happen. We should have been jumping up and down long before Opal Tower.
Not too much. It would make the building fall over, but sorry. It was there. I had to go over it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, look, there's been a fair amount of jumping up and down, but there are now more people doing it, and the voices are being heard for the first time. Yeah. And there is a threat that people will say, look, you can build as many apartment blocks as you want, but we're not going to move into them. We're not going to buy them. And that's the weird thing about this. Like, it's us, the people who ultimately pay for it. We are putting the money into the developers' funds for them to build the buildings. And we are the last people to be considered when things go wrong.
Mm. It's almost like we should go in with our own contract. You know, like, I'll buy it, but here's my contract.
Yeah.
You know, you'll sign this one. Thanks very much. You know?
Yeah. A few years ago, we looked at buying an investment property off the plan, and we got our solicitor to look at all the paperwork and the rest. It was a full ring binder, one of these big fat ring binders.
Yep.
And the developer said, you've got 2 weeks to go through this and agree to it. And our solicitor said, if you want me to do a proper job on this, it's going to be a month. Yeah, this is a lot of solid, detailed reading. Mm. So we pulled out of the purchase, and my life being what it is, if we'd hung in there, we would have made a small fortune. But there you go.
Is there much you could do? Like, let's think about that for a second. If given a ring binder of a contract and you go through it and you say, I don't like clause 43...
Mm.
Are they likely to take clause 43 out?
It depends. It depends very much on how much it's going to cost them and what it's going to undermine and what they're trying to do. But basically, a lot of these, if you imagine an apartment block in a complex of different apartment blocks that have certain shared common properties, so you've got all the stuff about the common property within that, your apartment block, but you've also got liabilities and responsibilities and access to other bits of common property, and already you can feel that ring binder starting to fill up. Yeah, yeah.
In fact, a second one just arrived.
Yes, exactly. But
Vanessa's asked a question on the text service which is relevant to this. She says, we bought a unit off the plan that's nearing completion.
Uh-huh.
Can you please ask Jimmy, who is responsible for checking the completion inspection of common areas. We're meant to inspect our unit,
yeah.
But we've seen lots of defects in other areas. Who signs off on the common areas when it's off the plan?
Well, strictly speaking, it's the owners' corporation, and that's all the owners working as a group after the first AGM. So what she should be doing is taking a note of this stuff, and then when she gets to her first AGM, I think it's part of the law now that they have to have on the agenda of the AGM that there will be an inspection of the common areas. So that's already there. She doesn't have to worry about it personally, except that she should take note of these things and when the appropriate time arises, say, look, I've noticed this, 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 and this, which might have been covered up, you know?
But the AGM is also, you're suggesting there, everyone's already moved in, right?
I think it's 1/3 of the owners have to have moved in before the first AGM.
Yeah, but I suppose what you'd want if I'm buying off the plan,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to move in and pay my last money until I say yep, okay, that's all done, isn't it? I mean, otherwise my bargaining's finished.
Well, okay. There's a couple of things. You've got 2 years for non-major defects to be identified and fixed, and you've got 6 years for major defects like cracking walls. That you can claim against them. So you've got a bit of a window in there from when the first people move in. You've also got the 2% defects bond that the developers put away somewhere to pay for any defects. I mean, it's pathetic, but it's there. Uh-huh. It's a start. So you have various safety nets so that even if you go into a building and you're seeing defects, that, you know, things that worry you, you needn't assume that they're not going to be fixed. However, there's a point where you would get quite radical with this if the building is quite clearly not up to standard. You would be pushing these things through very quickly.
Yeah. I suppose it just sort of, you know, kind of freaks me out a little bit. You know, we can bring it back to things like cars or furniture or other big items.
Yeah.
We don't buy things with defects.
No, you know,
like
no.
If I walked in and the car had cracked paint, I wouldn't go, oh, it's okay, they're going to repaint it in 6 months' time,
yeah.
You know, and it won't cost you anything. It's almost like, I don't really care about that. This is a thing that's meant to be brand new that I can already see a defect in.
And that's one of the problems with the culture is because we, are quite as being reasonable human beings, we spend a lot of money buying an apartment and we think, well, there must be all these safeguards there or the government wouldn't allow people to build shoddy buildings. And of course, we find out that the government does.
Yes. Wow. I mean, it's just, it does your head in. It does my head in.
Yeah. Like, well, you know.
How can this be? How can this be the environment? How can this be? What, you know, when we have all this sort of talk about Sydney planning and we're going to do this and it's going to be this great city and we're going to do the other and we're putting in a, you know, a terrific transport system, how about we build buildings that are decent?
Well, we're not the worst off by a long chalk, for different reasons, apartment owners in both Queensland and Victoria, for very different reasons, are worse off than we are. So I guess that's a slight positive on things. But what we really need is a federal strata building laws, bring in one set of laws that everybody can understand and adhere to, and that would be a terrific starting point.
Yeah. Talking to Jimmy Thompson from flat-chat.com.au. Now, if you've got questions, 1300 222 702 is the number. We could obviously keep on with this sort of stuff for a while, but I think we'd all just want to shut down and go and cry somewhere. Yeah. Let's look at some of the stuff that you might be living with right now. If you're living in strata, block of flats, apartments, then give us a 1300 222 702. Hello there, Karen. What did you want to bring up this afternoon?
Yes, hello. I think I was meant to be listening in to your chat here. I've just come home from a holiday and I have found a strata information that says that in future, if I move large-ish items in and out of my apartment, I will have to give notice to the executive committee so that somebody can supervise that. And I have a very funny feeling about this because I don't want anybody to know what I move in and out of my apartment. They mention a bylaw number so-and-so, which I'm not aware of. I must admit also that I'm not quite familiar with all this because I've just lost my husband and he has looked into that normally. So what is there a right to be present or somebody present when I move a large, like a sofa or anything in or out of my home?
Yeah, Karen, I'm just going to interrupt you. Your telephone line is just a little hard to understand, but I think I've got the gist of it. There's a bylaw that says someone's got to supervise moving out large items. You find that something of an invasion of privacy. Jimmy, what can you tell us?
This is not unusual. When you consider the number of people in any lift lobby who might be moving in and out over the course of a year, and given that the standard rental is 6 months. So if you've got tenants in the building and half of the strata units are occupied by tenants, there's a fair amount of to-ing and fro-ing, and this causes wear and tear. Now, the what drives the owners' corporation or the strata committee or the building manager nuts is when they're just wandering around, they find bashes and, you know, scrapes and whatever. Yeah. And this is especially for the lift, because in a lot of buildings, if you're moving something big, then they will want to put up some sort of padding in the lift. So, yeah, it feels like an intrusion, but it's actually a protection. And, you know, your privacy is the same, but you're just moving furniture, you know. Really, it's probably, and it saves you from, as an owner, as a resident, from having somebody say, I saw you move a sofa and there's a big scrape on the wall, and you're saying, no, it was those people next door, you know, when they moved their sideboard.
Mm. I suppose I can take a point, though, that if that's how she feels about it, you know, would there be a way of negotiating that? Is it some? I mean, I suppose what you're saying is that the owners' corporation should know that it's going to happen. So whatever preparations need to happen, that doesn't necessarily mean someone's got to be standing there watching what goes on, right?
No. Well, what often happens is that you set a time, because you don't want to be blocking up lifts that people are trying to use to get in and out of their apartments. You set a time and say, I'm going to be moving this at this point. Somebody will come around and just have a quick check before and a quick check after. And if those things are radically different in the after stage, then they can say, well, what happened here? But it's that thing of notifying. You know, it's when people start doing stuff on their own. You know, everybody wants to move house at the weekend, which means if you live in an apartment, then you're stuck either outside or inside while people are moving.
Yeah. Karen, thanks for your question. 1-300-222-702 is our number if you'd like to join us. Talking to Jimmy Thompson, talking about some of the issues that happen in strata. Jenny, thanks for your call. What's the issue?
Yes, hi. This also relates to common property talking about earlier. On a balcony of one unit in a block of about seven is a common property-owned pump taking rainwater from the tank beside it, a vertical tank, and circulating it to toilets and washing machines. But it's on the private tiled balcony of that unit, and there's no access and no designation of a common property where that pump stands. Should anything be done by that about that, or just fix the pump, which is now broken down, via getting access through that unit?
Okay, the just to clarify, in most apartment buildings, the balcony is common property. So it's not really private property, it's just that people have private access to that bit of common property. The question of the pump, There are aspects of strata law where if somebody doesn't allow the owner's corporation to go in and fix common property that requires access through the lot owner's property, they can go and get orders at NCAT so that the person has to allow them through the property to fix or even just to inspect where they think there might be a fault. It's a long process. It's much easier just to say to the person, look, here's a bottle of wine, let's come through and fix the pump.
Yeah. Are they reluctant, Jenny? Is that the issue?
No, it's just I thought it was strange that a commonly, you know, a pump serving the whole building is on, well, I thought it was, it's on their lot. It's marked on their, you know, like it's not marked, but it's on their private allotment within their allotment boundary, even though you tell me that the balcony is.
I would say 95% of cases, the balcony is common property. It has to be, because the structure of the balcony and the effect of things happening on the balcony on other apartments, you know, it can affect other people, it can affect the whole building. So that has to be retained as common property so it can be properly protected and maintained.
But
yeah,
on the
suppose it's
plan, it's not marked as common property. It's marked as part of that lot.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe that's part of the 5%. Even so, the pump.
But that's like, isn't that like the external walls are not marked? You know, as it's still on your lot, but they're common property, isn't it like that?
Yeah. So it's you look at the plans. It's a big, thick black line defines where common property begins and ends. And if that big, thick black line goes round the balcony rather than round the French windows the or whatever, right. the wall, then maybe it is lot property. Even so, the pump and the tank are common property, so the owner's corporation is allowed to request or even demand access to fix it.
Jenny, thanks for that. I suppose it's...
That part where the pump sits to make it, like, different strata property.
But what difference would it make, really?
Probably nothing.
Right,
really.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Get the bottle of wine. Buy a bottle of wine. It always works.
Okay.
Jenny,
thanks for your
call. I suppose it's just unusual to have infrastructure like that in one person's flat.
Yeah, I mean, this happens, you know, when apartments are built and nobody even thought about recycling rainwater. And
yeah,
so
right.
that no provision was made. And somebody has said, well, look, I think it's a great idea. Let me put the tank on my balcony and I'll cope with that.
Right.
And then you have this issue now that the pump is broken and it might be a totally different owner. Mm. You're saying, well, how do we access and fix it?
Yep. We're talking, this is, I've forgotten what we call it now.
Flat chat.
No, do we call it flat chat?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? I went to call it then and feel like we called it something else. This is Flat Chat with Jimmy Thompson.
Yeah.
We're talking strata. His website's called flat-chat.com.au if you want further details on all this. Time for one more, perhaps, from Glenn. What did you want to bring up, Glenn?
Yeah, hi. We've got 20 lots, but only 14 car spaces, and they're all on car stackers. And the original bylaw for the car stackers was that only the car space owners would pay for the maintenance, repair, insurance of the car stackers.
Yeah.
But what's happened since the year dot is that it's been treated like common property and just come out of the general funds.
Yeah.
And we're trying to resolve the problem, but we've had a lawyer tell us, oh, you could do this, you could do that, but ultimately it's going to go to a vote. And because there's always more car space owners than not, any vote will always go in their favour. So is there a way of trying to fairly resolve it? Because it's 6 versus 14, you know, to try and solve the problem.
Yeah, this is...
Sorry, can you just clarify for me? Are you saying that you've got a car in a car stacker in someone else's car space?
No. It's just you're part of the lot owner's lot area is the car space, like, if you know what I mean. But if certain 6 units don't have that car space at all. Yeah.
Right.
But they're having to pay their share of maintenance and...
Yes. It's at the moment, everyone pays towards it.
There is a principle, which I will now incorrectly name fraud against the minority, where everything that appears to be correct, you know, the right number of people have voted and everything looks okay, except a minority of people are suffering unfairly because of that vote. So the easiest thing is basically to go to, I would be going to your owner's corporation, to an AGM or even to the committee and saying, look, we can do this the reasonable way and sort this out amongst ourselves and pay back the money that we shouldn't have been paying would be a good start. Or we as a group will go to the tribunal and get them to order you to do it. Now, do you want to pay for lawyers to defend that or do you just want to give us our money?
Yeah.
But it is unfair and it's legally unfair and you have a very strong case.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been paying, maybe I missed it in the start, you've been paying for the maintenance of car spaces and car stackers, Glenn.
Well, they pay for the car spaces through their levies because it's part of their lot area, but the actual maintenance of those stackers, like mechanical repairs, and that's all been paid by everyone.
Yeah.
And I can never use that car space. So, but the problem is some of the equipment for the car stackers is on common property. So that's where it's got all messy, and that's where people can argue, oh, but some of it's on common property, so... we shouldn't be paying for stuff that's on common property.
It's my thing on common property. Yeah. It'd be like, yeah, be like me saying, I've just parked my yacht on the common property, therefore all repairs will be carried out as part of the strata, wouldn't it? I mean, like, it seems pretty good. Like, if you're getting to have a car space and a car stacker, that seems like you would pay for that.
Yeah, the exception would be if the levies on the apartments that don't have access to the car stackers were lower.
Yeah, no, they're not. They're lower in the sense that they're 14 square metres less, so you don't pay for that 14 square metres.
Right, but that's all. Yeah. You're not saving money on the maintenance of the car. Now you've got a good case. Good. Threaten them with the tribunal.
All right, okay. Glenn,
fantastic. Thanks for your call and excellent questions this afternoon. Flat-chat.com.au is where Jimmy usually dwells when he's not in this strange virtual broadcast space of today. And the kind of issues that we bring up there, he's been exploring for years, and you'll often find answers and further articles at that point. Mr. Thompson, thank you.
Good to talk to you.
We'll see you again very soon.
I hope so. Thanks, James.
Marvelous.
Well, that was James Valentine, and you can hear James's own podcasts on the ABC website. Now, I want to take you back to last week when I had a chat with Alex Greenwich, the MP for Sydney. Alex had a lot to say about rental and housing affordability and availability, his time on the TV show Filthy Rich and Homeless, and he had a few caustic things to say about Airbnb and the effect on homelessness, and Mark Latham, who he thinks could be a disaster for the New South Wales Parliament. Here's Alex. Now, you are MP for Sydney, which is the highest concentration, I think, of apartments, certainly in New South Wales, possibly in Australia, and therefore, almost by definition, the highest number of renters in New South Wales and possibly Australia. So, do you think renters are fairly treated?
Look, there have been some reforms which have helped to protect renters and protect renters' rights in terms of, you know, whether it is rental increases, whether it is the maintenance of rental properties. The outstanding issue we have around renters is no-fault evictions is still the case. So a property owner can kick someone out without any reason whatsoever. And that creates, again, a power imbalance.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly in the inner city, particularly in my electorate, rental costs are very competitive in a competitive up way, not a competitive down way. And those rental rate increases, which still happen, the ability for an owner to kick someone out is a concern. And again, it goes back to the issues around Airbnb. One of the main reasons I opposed that laissez-faire approach is we would see apartments, you know, potentially like the one I live in and I rent. It would be in my landlord's financial interest to kick my husband and I out and to charge, you know, per night or the same for, say, two nights as we pay in a week. So it was so important that we were able to get the ban on investment properties and a limit in place there. But renters have to deal with an ever-changing market. They don't have the protections that they, you know, they can stay in their place without risk of being kicked out.
Mm.
And it can be a very competitive market with terms for rents also decreasing, in my experience, from more 6 month than 12 month leases happening now, and that doesn't give people that security.
And then there's the issue of affordable housing, which is related to, in some way, which could either be in the private or public sector. I mean, we up in King's Cross, we look down into Woolloomooloo, and there's a big chunk of Housing Commission housing, and you can tell that developers would just love to get their hands on that. What do you think? I mean, should the government could turn around, as they've done with the Sirius Tower, and say, when we sell this to developers, we'll be able to build three times as many houses far, far away. What do you think? Is it fair game, or should we kind of force a mixture of housing in areas like the one we live in?
Having the mixture of housing is critical. In any global city, in any locality, you will have people on a mixture of income and a mixture of need. So in New South Wales, we have 38,000 people who are homeless, the highest numbers within the inner city. We have a social housing waiting list of 60,000 tenancies, and something like, you know, a tiny percentage of affordable rental houses across the state, with many people reporting they are in rental stress. The problem which we've faced with the way the government has approached it over the past 6 to 10 years has been a very siloed approach to housing policy and homelessness. So you've got homelessness strategy, which is we're going to throw money at homelessness services. You've got housing strategy, which is we need to be building a lot and we're going to get that stamp duty to be able to pay for other things. And then we have a social housing portfolio, which is going to have to eat itself to feed itself, because we're not going to invest any more in it. We're just going to flog things off and build apartments or houses somewhere else.
Yeah.
That siloed approach has created the crisis we're in, where you have people sleeping in cars, sleeping rough, in rundown boarding houses, where you have that strong waiting list, and where we have no targets for affordable housing in major redevelopments. No targets. I've met with property developers who ask me, why don't we have affordable housing targets? What, you know, there have been opportunities for the government to mandate affordable housing in places, whether it's Bays Precinct, Metro, Barangaroo, to be able to say...
But how do you do that? How do you tell a developer, you've got to make some of your house, the flats that you're building, it probably would be flats, you've got to make them affordable. Do they have to then become the landlord and fix the rent? Is that what you're talking about?
So there's different ways to do it. It could be that that developer becomes the landlord and fixes the rent at an affordable rate. It could be that they partner with a community housing provider to do that for them. It could be that the government manages a cohort of those properties and they have that, you know, that is for people on the public housing waiting list. These are models which have worked overseas. They've largely worked in the UK and in London. They've been successful in Vancouver and San Francisco. With the population in the inner city continuing to grow, with homelessness continuing to be on the rise, we need to be mandating a target of somewhere between 15 to 20% of affordable housing in new major redevelopments. But we also need to be building the new supply. People on low incomes need to be able to live close to jobs in the inner city.
Right.
People who are vulnerable, elderly, in need of services, need to be close to those services, which are often in the inner city.
Yeah.
Cities need to have that mix. We can't just be a city where everybody is just a high income earner and rents are out of control. Our city would stop. You need to have a mix of income levels. And you have to realize that in any society, you need to have a safety net for vulnerable people who could be dealing with a disability, who could be victims of domestic or family violence, who could have substance or mental health issues, people who, you know, could fall through the cracks. Mm. We don't want to keep them in the cracks. We need to make sure there is that safety net of housing for them.
Now, you did the TV show...
Filthy Rich and Homeless.
Filthy Rich and Homeless. Did that just confirm some of your fears about homelessness, or did it open up a whole new aspect that you hadn't even realized existed?
You know, I grew up in the inner city and I have been around homelessness. I've seen it. I've not experienced it personally until I was on that show. But my parents were never people who sort of kept me sheltered from people who are homeless or sex workers, or explained to me that, you know, that's a person who's an injecting drug user. I've known that in our city we have a mix of people.
Yeah.
But I really did not understand homelessness until I participated in that series. I didn't realize something as obvious as people are homeless because we don't have enough safe and affordable housing. And I didn't realize that anybody could become homeless.
Right.
It just takes either one or a collection of bad experiences, and you can become homeless.
Right.
And particularly with the tipping point that so many people are financially living week to week, it could be a rental increase. It could be a poor investment. It could be an interest rate increase for a loan that you're overly leveraged on. It could be a family breakdown. It could be a workplace injury, and suddenly you can become homeless.
Right.
What I also found very confronting is the way in which we deal with it. So we throw money at temporary crisis accommodation,
yeah,
where people can stay for up to 28 weeks, where the model of care that works is supported transitional housing, where people are wrapped around with the services they need and the help to get back on their feet. We're not doing that to the level we need to be doing that in New South Wales. We're not providing the housing, the permanent housing pathway to people. And homelessness is increasing in New South Wales at twice the national average. So I'm hopeful and have been working with government and the opposition to actually identify that we have a homelessness crisis in New South Wales. And I've been trying to work with my colleagues in the New South Wales Parliament to realise that we all have homeless constituents. And even though they're not on the electoral roll because they don't have a permanent address, they are still our responsibility to help and to represent. And so I'd like to see in the next parliament, we really all come together and have a strong commitment to ending and heavily reducing homelessness.
And that leads me neatly to my last question, because looking at the polls, 4.3 swing predicted last week against the government. That could change, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the marginal seats we've spoken about, and even more marginal seats like Orange, where mm-hmm. the shooters are 0.1% ahead on the last poll. So obviously things are going to change.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very strong possibility of a hung parliament. We're seeing today in federal parliament the crossbench changing or trying to change government policy on asylum seekers. What is your dream team for the crossbench after the election? Presuming, and you're in a reasonably safe position, I would say, I dare say, touch wood, you're in a good position, but who would you see on your crossbench dream team after the election?
Well, like you say, you know, the election is still 40 days away, and a day in politics is a long time. 40 days is a very long time. And polls are narrowing. It will be interesting to see where they're narrowing and the seats that are in play. We also don't know what the makeup of the crossbench will look like. We don't know what the makeup of the upper house crossbench will look like. And we just don't know the makeup of the parliament yet. We'll know it soon after the 23rd of March, maybe not immediately. It may still well be a week or so before some seats are finalised. You know, people across from Macquarie Street know that I have a very strong working relationship with Greg Piper, the other independent, and he and I will work together. You know, whether or not where there is a minority government situation, to help to reform the parliament, to make it more democratic, to ensure that there is as much political stability as possible, to make sure that vulnerable groups are looked after, to make sure that there is proper action on climate change. But we don't know who else could be in the mix.
Mm.
And there could be various different people with competing or complementing views and values. Whoever it is, if we're in that situation, the people who I would work with are people who share my values, who share the values of my electorate, obviously, and who are committed to political stability. Since I have been elected, there have been three premiers and three leaders of the opposition.
Right.
We need to make sure our parliament is functioning well, and we need to make sure that our crossbench is contributing to parliament delivering for the community. My biggest concern in the next parliament is the makeup of the upper house crossbench. The prospect of having people like Mark Latham,
yeah,
and other populists elected, yeah, who are there for grandstanding, not there for public policy,
yeah,
is deeply concerning.
Yeah.
So it will be important for that lower house crossbench to be able to combat the toxic nature that people like Mark Latham will bring to Macquarie Street. How's that for a non-answer?
Yeah, it's a great non-answer. It's the best non-answer. I was wondering when you were going to get round to him. Are you worried about the Greens? Talking about political stability, there seems to be a certain fluidity or flux in there.
Look, I work really well with a number of members of the Greens. Jenny Leong is my neighbouring MP, as is Jamie Parker.
Yeah.
And Tamara and I, the member for Ballina, have worked quite closely on short-term letting stuff. The upper house, there's a great mixture of talent there. I actually believe that we need a strong, cohesive, functioning Greens Party in New South Wales, and it is in the benefit of the Parliament that there is one. And I also have the same view about the Liberal Party and the Labor Party. I don't think people in the general public like to see necessarily infighting, but parties have to go through their own processes and resolve them. I think the Greens are going to this election with some really good policy commitments,
right,
and with some really talented people. And I think across the political spectrum, that is happening. And obviously, you know, I look forward to working with them as I do in this parliament, in the next parliament.
Yeah.
And appreciate the views that they bring to Macquarie Street.
And finally, out in the hustings, what's the feedback you're getting? What are the issues that your voters, potential voters, are concerned about?
You know, people in the Sydney electorate are concerned with some really big statewide issues and statewide policy issues. So whether it is voluntary euthanasia, whether it is pill testing and drug harm minimisation, people are concerned about those. People are concerned about action on climate change and switching to investment in renewables. People are also concerned about local developments. You know, the Sydney electorate is one where there are constantly cranes and major redevelopments occurring. I was door knocking in Paddington and Darlinghurst on the weekend, and people are appalled about the stadium knocked down and rebuilt, as am I. I was in Pyrmont last week, and there's plans for a one or two concrete batching plants and a high intensity multi-user ports facility. People are really concerned about that. People are concerned about the two giant casino towers which are going up.
Yeah.
So there's a number of local issues, but there's other important statewide issues that people are concerned about.
Okay, well, I think we've gone longer than I thought we were going to. Alex, thank you so much for your time.
And, thank you, Jimmy.
I will edit out all my bits just to get to you. Thanks very much.
Awesome, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Flat Chat Wrap. You can catch us every week by subscribing to iTunes or whatever platform you listen to the podcast on at the moment. And you can keep up to date with whatever is happening in the world of apartment living through flat-chat.com.au. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again next week.